Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. Houston's community station, 90.1 FM and FM HD1. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated and it airs on other radio stations in different cities in the US and Europe. During the previous episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1071, which is already archived on our website arabvoices.net, I aired a lecture by Professor Bassam Haddad titled Navigating Anti-Imperialism and Anti-Authoritarianism, the Syrian Uprising and the Question of Palestine. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1072, I will air the question and answer session that followed his lecture. Dr. Bassam Haddad, an associate professor at the Shar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University, delivered that lecture on May 24, 2023 at the annual Hisham Sharabi Memorial Lecture organized by the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. The annual lecture is dedicated to Professor Hisham Sharabi, the founder of the Jerusalem Fund and Palestine Center. And in case you missed that lecture I aired last week, Professor Haddad discussed in his talk the complexities of the Syrian uprising and how interventions by regional actors ostensibly supporting the uprising had a detrimental effect on its original inclusive nature, which led to the sectarianization, weaponization, and internationalization of the uprising. He also addressed the significant implications of the devastating Syrian war on Syrians, Palestinians, and the region. He addressed the interplay between the Syrian situation and its influence on the Palestine question, particularly within the dynamic landscape of shifting alliances in the region. Professor Haddad's lecture emphasized the need for a nuanced understanding of the intricacies surrounding the Syrian case, highlighting its far-reaching repercussions within Syria and the broader Middle East. Again, that lecture is already archived on our website, arabvoices.net, and you can listen to it anytime on that website. Let's listen now to the question and answer session that followed his lecture, and we'll begin with brief remarks and questions by Saeed Ariqat, a member of the Palestine Center Committee and the Washington Bureau Chief of the Palestinian newspaper, Al-Quds.
Syria is a place that is very dear to me. It's a place where I visited a great deal every year, many times. It's a place where I got married. It's a place where I got arrested, you know, and things of that nature. So it's a place where my oldest brother went to college for free and was educated and so on. So that was Syria in every sense. It was a place that was open for all Arabs to come and live and go to school and do all these things and get medical care and all these things. I must say that, you know, I, for one, and I think you and I have spoken about this issue before, I was never taken by the so-called popular uprising. You know, I never saw it that way. I knew the sentiments of the Syrians. I met a lot of Syrians over the years. But I knew also that the United States of America has always applied it against Syria. I mean, it's something that I have discussed with American diplomats, the last Syrian ambassador, who was before that deputy ambassador in Iraq, and I met him there and so on. So I don't want to delve into this, but we need to remember that Syria, before this thing, was a country that had zero debts. It was providing for its people. It was producing everything. It was exporting drugs and medicines and so on to 93 countries. I can go on and on and on. And I know that in this town, you know, right after the invasion of Iraq, the most popular sentiment is, when are we going to Syria? It was people like Bill Kristol and others, you know, the Winner people, the other people, the APACers and so on. They were always saying, when are we going to Syria next? You know, we all remember the 14 points that were submitted by Colin Powell to Syria. So, you know, I don't buy this thing. Of course, there was sentiment. And there was, you know, people hate authoritarianism. And there was a strong sentiment. But almost from day one, the plot was to do to Syria what they have done to Syria. And, you know, imagine for a moment if the state and the army were not able to withstand this war. It was almost a global war. Lloyd Austin himself, in a Senate hearing, he said that they trained 100,000. They spent at that time, that was like 8 years ago when he was chairman, they spent over $500 million in training militants and so on that have morphed into ISIS and others. So I don't want to go on. My question, I have a question, you know, and not just a sentiment to you, is this. Are we at the end of America's plotting against the Syrian state, or are we likely to see more of this thing? See, you know, listening to Bob Menendez and Rich and others that go around sending letters and all these things to others. And my second question, would the Saudis have actually, you know, returned to Syria or, you know, brought Syria back into the air fold without America's green light? Thank you.
Well, Ahlan Saeed. So basically, I have to say that I am not concerned with the plots the U.S. has against Syria personally, even though I know they exist. And I'm not concerned because I'm just not concerned, period. Because at a time of a popular uprising against decades, not just of political repression and subjugation, but also neoliberal economic policies that impoverished a large number of Syrians for the sake of the few, I'm concerned with following this path that the Syrians who took to the streets wanted to take. So we have to be clear. We cannot just mix the bag and say, because there are designs on Syria, then we have to sort of, you know, do X, Y, Z. Now, the fact that in reality, the actual uprising itself underwent change and was transformed in terms of who was taking to the streets and what they were doing and for what purpose. Yes, this is precisely why people like myself were skeptical, but not skeptical enough to stop supporting the idea and practice of a real revolution in Syria, but skeptical enough to take pause and to critique the divergence. We cannot be slaves to U.S. designs, because U.S. has designs everywhere. And if we do that, then we are not actually going to support any change in the region, because any change in the region is going to collide with U.S. designs, or the U.S. is going to try to subvert it for its own purposes. So on the one hand, I understand the designs, but that's not good enough reasons to sort of stop supporting the Syrian uprising. The reason I personally hit the brakes in supporting what was going on the ground is because what was going on the ground contradicted the Syrian uprising as it started the first few months and moved in a direction that was more totalitarian. I don't use the word jihadist or even Islamist or extremist because they're all problematic. The rebels spearheading the uprising in Syria after a couple of years were totalitarian, and they had no intention of doing what the people that took the streets in the beginning wanted to do. That's why I was skeptical. The fact that there were U.S. designs and the fact that Qatar and Saudi Arabia will actually move in the direction of what is lucrative to them is another story. And this is one of the reasons why when I spoke with one of my friends in Syria, dear friend, we met in Chicago. I gave a keynote at a University of Chicago at a conference. I was one of the speakers. And then I asked him, because he actually was part of the Syrian National Council who flew to Qatar back and forth and to Turkey back and forth. And I told him, why are you doing this? You basically historically have been critical of these countries and how they treated their own populations and how they supported Assad for decades. He basically said, we have no choice. We just have to go with whoever's helping us. It's basically was putting forth a realpolitik approach. And I said, okay, that's not so bad. But the calculus is wrong. This realpolitik approach that you're pursuing is not going to result in the toppling of Assad. When you have profoundly problematic states like Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United States supporting an uprising, there's nothing good that's going to come out of it. So even the calculus from a devil's advocate approach or a realpolitik approach, where the means justify the end, is mistaken. The calculus is wrong. So you're losing reputation and you're going to lose the uprising. And of course, we never talked after. And this is what ended up happening. This is why I keep asking, how can this uprising fall apart when it is so easy to revolt against a repressive, brutal dictatorship like Syria's, not just politically, but also economically. And it's because of the problematic forces amassed behind the uprising, and partly because those of us, or many of us, or the people that supported the uprising, even after it changed course, didn't speak out, weren't as loud in condemning that shift in direction of the uprising. But I will not take U.S. designs on the region to be my yellow card or red card, to be like, no, we cannot go on with this process of revolting against dictatorship. I think we must keep going, just like in the question of Palestine, we must keep going in the direction that is principled, regardless of who is on the other side. The U.S. will always do what it does, and I will not go by, be guided by its designs. As to the other question, I don't know if Saudi Arabia took the green light from the United States to welcome Assad. I actually think that Saudi Arabia is hedging its bets. It's playing a smart game, literally a smart game now with the involvement of China, although I'm not sure how principled that game is. But right now, it seems that it's hedging its bets and it's trying to do what it wants to do. I think there is I'm not going to get into Saudi Arabia very much, but the leadership in Saudi Arabia has a vision that is apolitical, that is mostly economic in terms of Saudi Arabia's health and wealth and prosperity, and it's ultimately its political position. And it's actually open to peace, even with Iran, largely because it wants to preserve that vision. And the US right now and Saudi Arabia, you know more than I do, are not in good standing. And you had asked me about the connection with China. Of course, I mean, I'm not one of those people who think that, oh, China's here now, we have an opportunity to basically choose, or we have some sort of balance of power that we can leverage. I'm not as confident as many people, especially in the Arab world, especially on channels like Al-Malik Mayadeen and others, who many, not all, are assuming that, okay, now we are back to some sort of a bipolar global politics. I don't think we are there now, and I'm not one of those people who is confident about how China will actually be producing positive results for people in the region. So I'm skeptical as well.
What is your alternative option?
The funny thing is that some of the revolutionaries that support the Syrian uprising, that supported the Syrian uprising throughout the whole years, who were critiquing some of my statements about the direction of the uprising. You know, what was funny is that when from the early 1990s, 93, 94, up to now, I've devoted all my intellectual production on Syria to providing profound critique and condemnation of the Syrian regime. And people who just woke up to the notion of Syria in 2011 were, you know, taken aback by my critique of the direction of the uprising. My position is there needs to be a total and comprehensive change in the direction of emancipatory politics in the region, including and especially probably in Syria, and precisely for the sake of larger causes like the Palestine questions. Now, if this is happening, I'm all for it. But when this process begins to be diverted in a direction that will actually re-empower the Syrian regime, just like it did ultimately, because the Syrian regime have friends that will fight to the death to keep it alive because they have an existential stake in it, then I am going to be skeptical about the direction of the uprising, but I maintain solidly my position in support of a revolution in Syria until today. So I have written about this and I shared what you asked me. Yes, my position is perhaps privileged. I'm sitting far away. And on principle, I'm not willing to change my position on the brutality of the Syrian regime. But I'm also not going to follow the direction of the uprising that was seeking, at least the spearhead of the uprising that was seeking a theocratic outcome that is in contradiction with everything about the uprising. So and my position is with a revolution in Syria, but not the actual uprising that was taking hold after 2013. And that doesn't put me at all, as you heard, in the camp of those who actually take that argument so far to the point where it's as far as I'm concerned, they're two sides of the same coin.
The next question is from Noor Ariqat, a university professor, legal scholar, author, and a human rights attorney.
I want to thank you for a very comprehensive talk. I felt like I think that you distilled a lot of emotional reaction and sentiment, and were able to parse through it using a tremendous amount of research and empirical data, which speaks to the work that you were nodding to. And as somebody that is a student and a comrade of yours, I still learned so much and want to ask you a couple of follow-up questions to the things that you said that builds on what was asked before. Specifically, here's something that you said, and then I'll ask you two questions that flow from it. So you said calamities of this scale do not just happen between a state and its local population. You stated it twice to suggest what you weren't saying, which is what you suggested multiple times. There was a particular moment when this pivots from a popular uprising to a regional proxy war. And yet in previous iterations, you periodized that, I think, more clearly than we heard this time. So there was something about the first few months of the uprising, and then there was 2013 as a moment, and then 2014 and 2015 as a moment. So if you can more clearly, in your research, where do you pinpoint this pivot from popular uprising to regional proxy war? Right. And then secondly, related to this question, you have a certain all revolutions are messy. None are pure. So is there a moment where it got too far, where those who stayed involved just should have left? Was there a moment? What should they have tolerated as staying in? Because there's also something to be said for those who remained committed. They're not sheep. They have agency and knew what they were doing. What do we say of their agency and the decisions that they were making in the calculus of the messy versus what needed to happen?
You know, I actually, you know, don't want to go through the prioritization because it becomes like, you know, unwieldy. But I do, yes, the scale question that I shared is to make a point about proportionality, right? If a popular uprising within a country against a state that is armed to the teeth with policing capabilities and so on took place, there will be, of course, casualties among the repressive regime. But the scale of the casualties demonstrates that this is not just an uprising against a regime and then there are, you know, consequences like casualties on both sides. Because in reality, the number of casualties on the regime side speaks to the interference, intervention, and existence of a real war supported by actors way outside the local groups. So that point is simply to suggest that there is a transformation into a proxy regional and international war in a way that should allow us to look at the uprising as something other than what it was early on, and as a result, to wonder whether this path, especially considering the goals, the explicit goals, forget the behavior and forget the, you know, the violence of some of the rebels, because they lived under the Assad regime, and in many ways they were copying, and this happens in revolutions and happens. That's not what I'm referring to, even though, you know, we all, you know, condemn those sorts of things. But what I'm referring to is that this opposition has, and speaking to your second question, this opposition on the ground, in the battlefield, I'm not talking about Syrians who actually are the victims and all of this, the victims of everyone, with the regime holding or bearing the primary responsibility for everything. But those spearheading the uprising on the battlefield changed the direction of the uprising to something different. So I am not looking for a perfect revolution. In fact, of course, there's no such thing. But when the direction of the uprising or the demands of the revolt early on is actually completely reversed to something reprehensibly theocratic, reprehensibly authoritarian, reprehensibly violent, reprehensibly exclusionary, that's not an imperfect revolution. That's a different war altogether that is being fought on behalf of a sentiment, an ideology, an orientation, a goal that is completely divorced from the reasons why millions of Syrians took to the streets and fought bullets with their bare bodies.
Talking about the uprising, to me, this is all planned from the very beginning after 1973 war and almost devastated Israel. And even Diane wanted to his atomic bomb to get it to the war. Then they started planning, which we never do. They marginalized Egypt. And all these uprisings are all planned to destroy or weaken whatever you want to do in these countries around. And we saw the results of all of these. Then came the uprising in Syria, which was discussed all the time here. I was with it at the very beginning. I know I was in surgery all day, but when I go home, I read everything before I sleep. Then it's less than a year. It showed it was invented. And it showed to destroy Syria as they did to Iraq, as they did to Egypt. They did to everything. This is where I even stopped listening to Al Jazeera. And I never listened to Al Jazeera since then. Because you can tell, and the only one who saved Syria was the Soviet Union or Russia. At that time, it was no Soviet Union. So my question is, you tell me brutality and brutality. Show me any one of them who does not have a brutal regime, who does not kill, who does not do anything among all the Arab countries. Show me one. Saddam Hussein used to be in his cabinet meeting. If you say something against him, he would shoot you in the meeting. So why we want to get Bashar al-Assad or Hafez al-Assad alone? They are all the same. Show me anyone. Thank you.
I can't show you anyone because they're all... I can't. They all do the same things or similar things. But we're talking about an actual uprising in an actual case, and I support it. And I support its principles, and I still do. And going back to Noura's question, what about those people that continue to support the uprising? Well, guess what? I'm with these people. But if you ask these people, like I did, what are you supporting now? And they say, I'm supporting the revolution. And I asked, what revolution? And they say the revolution to overthrow the regime and replace it with a more inclusive and any just alternative. And I said, what about the people who are spearheading the actual battle, the battles on the ground? And they say, I don't support them, but I support the revolution. So I would say, well, me too. Now, yes, in the heat of the moment, people didn't make these distinctions, at least not publicly. They would speak of themselves as supporters of the revolution. But when you ask them, is the direction of Jabhat al-Nusra or Ahrar al-Sham or whatever it is that was at the time leading, spearheading the battlefield, they say, no, this is not my cup of tea. We don't have any differences. It's just now it appears to be much more of a nomenclature question, whereby in the heat of the moment, those distinctions weren't made. But now they are being made. Now people are basically being very open about, these people almost stole the revolution from us. And the Syrians who persevered and fought to keep their towns and neighborhoods alive are the real heroes, but they were at home. If you ask them, and I'm talking about Syrians, and I kind of have to say there's a big difference between people like me living out here and all my interlocutors, friends or detractors, and then the people who are in Syria, who actually sidestepped all of our silly debates. Because if you ask them in Syria, which I did, because I'm in contact with them on a weekly, if not daily basis, how come you're not going to the streets anymore? And how come you're not choosing to go fight? And they are the ones who actually have been imprisoned by the regime, tortured by the regime, have relatives that are killed by the regime. They say, fight with whom? Right? So we're on the same page now. But during the uprising, the situation and the context and the atmosphere was so toxic, we couldn't actually get along. And Dr. Musa, no, I can't point to any regime, authoritarian regime, that doesn't have this behavior. I mean, we could say that Iraq first and then Syria, close second, have been historically more brutal. If you look at the statistics, have been historically more repressive. If you look at various statistics, I'm not talking about Random House Freedom Index, which is very problematic. I'm talking about the experience of real people in Syria, real men who are 40, 50, and 60 years old, who urinate in their pants when they have a knock on the door simply because they know that they've written an article a week ago that was mildly critical of a second level functionary. That's what I'm referring to. This doesn't always happen in all authoritarian regimes. So there is a difference on the one hand, but no, no regime is free from these. Sorry?
Look what happened to
I'm with you. That's what I'm saying. No authoritarian regime has actually evaded that. And, you know, you bring up the question of Saudi Arabia, and I don't want to cause jihad and the center a problem, but we all know that if there is a serious movement in Saudi Arabia, it'll probably be the most regionally popular movement in the world against Saudi Arabia.
The next question is from Miko Pellet, an Israeli-American activist and author.
I want to thank you, Professor Haddad, for a really fantastic, illuminating lecture. I've been confused by the Syrian issue for a very long time. I remember the first time I saw it or experienced a split that it created in the Palestine solidarity groups. I can't remember where I was. It was very early on. And the person that I was supposed to give a talk and the person hosting the event apologized because half of the people that were supposed to come didn't come because he himself, I forget what his position was, but they opposed his position on Syria. And I thought, why aren't they coming to a talk about Palestine because they oppose somebody's opinion on Syria? So this is very early on. But my question to you is this, in connection to Palestine, now that Syria is weakened, obviously, and licking its wound, is there a possibility that it will join the Abraham Accords? Because this is kind of the, in a way, a golden key to joining the kind of the regimes that are slightly safer, that are friends with the US, that have those kinds of privileges. So is there, and I think it would be a terrible thing, of course, but is this a realistic expectation that Syria would be the next to join the Abraham Accords?
No.
Elaborate.
I mean, everything about that camp, which includes Syria and Iran, of course, and Hezbollah, is antithetical to these accords. It just can't happen. Now, Saudi Arabia and the proximity that we've seen with Syria, I think, is part of a larger question that's happening in the region. So if you look at what's happening in Yemen vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia, you'll see that there is, and of course, the deal, quotation marks, brokered by China, you'll see that there might be a trade-off between Iran and Saudi Arabia as to Syria and Yemen. You get your hands off of Yemen, I'll get my hands off of Syria. In other words, there is some sort of a trade-off, and you are also seeing developments that point in that direction, whereby you get Syria, I get Yemen, or you get your hands off Syria, I get my hands off Yemen. So there's that happening. And I think that dynamic is over and above other things that have to do with the United States and other topics. In fact, there is talk now. I mean, I don't know. These things could be reversed, that, you know, one of the countries that's one of the actors that's not happy about what's happening is Israel, because Saudi Arabia was moving in a particular direction fast, very fast. And now I'm not sure if it's reversed that direction, but it's also moving in another direction. And I'm not one of those people who feel that this is not going to be reversed. I think this might actually, I'm one of the people who thinks this might be temporary. The entire Chinese involvement, the Iran Saudi Arabia connection, I am not as confident as others in its durability.
It seems that some of the more, you know, countries that are less likely to join the Abraham Accords, like or to normalize with Israel, like Indonesia, Malaysia, you know, Pakistan, there are voices within those countries that are calling for normalization. And I'm wondering if it's not just a safe bet for the regime in Syria to join that.
Oh, I mean,
it wouldn't be a safe thing for them to do.
I don't think, I see what you're, okay. I don't think the regime's decision-making is autonomous. It wasn't autonomous to begin with years ago. It was connected to other considerations. But today, on these questions, it's certainly not autonomous. So it's not whether the regime wants or doesn't want. It's close allies, those who have actually literally saved it, will have a say. And I don't think this formula is on the cards, is in the cards. I don't think, I mean, I would be happy to be proven, not happy, actually, I wouldn't be very happy at all to be proven wrong, but I'll accept to be proven wrong. But I'll be extremely surprised if, because the Abraham Accords, I mean, have you read them?
You're listening to Arab Voices, coming to you from the studios of KPFT Houston since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. What we are listening to is the question and answer session that followed the lecture delivered by Professor Bassam Haddad titled Navigating Anti-Imperialism and Anti-Authoritarianism, the Syrian Uprising and the Question of Palestine. Bassam Haddad is an associate professor at the Shar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. He delivered that lecture on May 24, 2023, at the annual Hisham Sharabi Memorial Lecture hosted by the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. I had aired that lecture during the previous episode of Arab Voices, and it is already archived on our website, arabvoices.net. Let's continue listening to the remaining questions and answers that followed the lecture.
I think almost everybody in the world was horrified by what happened in Syria and this just slow motion destruction and utter, you know, torture of the people. You know, Obama should have never let the Russians, you know, fight in the Middle East. But I'm interested that you think that, you know, you actually do believe that that the jihadis or the, you know, extremists had kind of taken over the movement, because I really wasn't very sure about that. Another thing that I
think, on the battlefield, I always reference the battlefield, mm-hmm. on the battlefield, yeah.
But the another thing that I really wonder if how much of it played a part in it was the experience in Iraq, because Syria was the only place in the world where a brutal Shiite leadership ruled a large Sunni majority of populace. And, you know, there really was a possibility that if that Assad had been overthrown, that there would have been a real serious massacre in that country, and probably, you know, partially supported by all the Sunni countries around it. And how much do you think that was, you know, maybe a contributor to the inaction of America and really the entire world, where we just watched these, you know, these people just be bombed to whatever. And by the way, I'm a Russian expert, but I think the whole creation of the refugee crisis was part of the design, you know, to drive million people out, you know, into Europe and promote the neo-fascist parties and stuff that all love Putin.
There's a lot going on in your question. And there are some terms that I think are not accurate, such as the Syrian regime is predominantly at the very top, not all, but predominantly is Alawi, it's not Shi'i. And Alawism doesn't rule Syria, right? I mean, that's one of the reasons, one of the things that are, I think, are misnomers, even though they have disproportional influence, but they don't, basically in Syria, you don't have Alawi, pro-Alawi policies, right? Alawi communities are as impoverished and in many ways repressed as many others. But yes, the ruling class is disproportionately Alawi. So the sectarian argument is something that I don't support. And I also don't support that if there was a takeover by the opposition, that there will be a massacre of Alawi. I don't support these narratives. I mean, it's also a narrative that we hear in other places, such as Israel. I don't think there will be a massacre. And it all depends, of course, on who is replacing the regime, but things are not as simple. I think that's a narrative that the regime or regime supporters more so peddle in order to scare people into supporting the regime. I think things are much more complex than that. And at the same time, if there is a replacement or if there is an overthrow, things are far less dramatic than what this narrative suggests. But I there's a lot in the premise of what you shared that I don't support. So in all cases, I don't see things in sectarian terms, and I don't see those outcomes as I don't see the problem as such. The problem is mainly, in my view, that the uprising in Syria is a legitimate uprising, or the issue is it's a legitimate uprising that was thwarted. So and then from there, that's when imperialism, or, and I put this in quotation marks because people have been different things by it, played a role. But in terms of the designs and in terms of how everything was designed decades ago, I'm not a big fan of this rhetoric, because every political actor uses design, the question of designs, to its advantage. And I don't think we have designs anymore. People, it's obvious what countries are doing. The US invaded and destroyed an entire country, Iraq, in 2003. There were no designs. I mean, it just wanted to do what it did for reasons that were evident. It wanted to remake the Middle East in ways that supports its own politics and the politics of its allies. So I'm not very big on these on some of these designs schemes. I think Rama had a question earlier.
Oh, thank you, Bassam. Two questions. One related to Syrian question of Palestine. If you can speak to the impact of the revolution and counter-revolution on Palestinian refugee communities within Syria. And then the second one is kind of related to the problems of discourse that we were talking to throughout your talk. I think one particular one, and it relates to maybe it's hard to have hope in this moment, in this part, you know, with Bashar being accepted in the league, the country destroyed. But I think part of what's been frustrating the last decade or so is that so much conversation is about the military, the geopolitics, and many times that just gets the attention. And so the on the ground, what people are doing day to day, both, you know, in the immediate of the uprising, but also lasted several years through into, doesn't get as much attention. And how does that then impact then the way we are able to relate when it just becomes, it's too big of a problem, it's geopolitics, I can't engage in this.
So can you just summarize the second point, like what you want me to address, just so I don't misunderstand?
Just in terms of like what it means when the discourse also becomes so much into the military and the battleground and the geopolitics at the expense of what I think is more hopeful in terms of how people are continuing to survive day to day and organize on the ground.
I mean, very quickly, the Palestinian refugees in Syria, of course, like all Syrians, frankly, have actually been subject to the same context of repression, of economic destitution and decline and all of that prior to the uprising. And I didn't see that there is a significant difference between these communities inside Syria and the rest of Syrians in general. You would find actually people among them that had a different take on the transformation of, or the change that took place within the uprising, because some people don't like the word transformation and the change in direction. But I don't think that there is a significant difference between the reaction of the refugees compared to Palestinian refugees in Syria compared to the rest of Syrians. So it could be that based on micro studies, one can actually get a bit deeper, but there's nothing that jumps at you in terms of a statistically significant difference. The problem, of course, is that, you know, people that are twice and thrice displaced, they're going to always be under that much more duress and so on. On the other question, I mean, this is what I'm trying to say. The principal hero and victim in all of this are Syrian people who made sure that they kept their towns and neighborhoods and families alive throughout this, which is something that was completely absent from the media because it was not a sensational thing to cover. But these are the people that actually give hope. And the better or more optimistic development in Syria is that those, and I shared this in the talk, is that those who, including Alawi communities, by the way, that at the time sided with the regime, not all because they support the regime, but also because, but primarily because they don't like the alternative, are now actually extremely resentful. And there is a sense that if there is a go again, that the social and political learning that took place at all levels, unfortunately also at the regime's level, is going to be in play. But the positive thing about this is that the regime played its cards right in terms of pursuing what it pursued in the most problematic manner, in the most reprehensible manner, but it was able to do that, except that the opposition and many of us didn't. And I think we are to benefit from a reproduction of these circumstances, which everyone now might wonder when this might happen again, not just in the case of Syria, but also in the case of Egypt, for instance, and so on. In my view, as somebody who follows the region and studies it and teaches it and writes about it, I don't think this is happening very soon, at least not in a collective manner across countries. But there is, in my view, a very important task for all of us, and that is to begin establishing forms of solidarity and joint struggle, first of all, that blur boundaries and borders. And that is something that, unfortunately, if you look at what's happening, is not being done. And maybe it's being done within countries, but even within countries, even in the case of Syria, if you look at the NGOization of various pro-human rights or human rights-oriented groups, everything is happening at a level that is compartmentalized. And I unfortunately think this is this doesn't bode well for another circumstance where these conditions reproduce the need to go to the streets, the need to actually and the need and the capacity to do this. But you know, I'm very hopeful that people are aware that if this indeed does happen again, you will see a very different behavior among not just those who are the natural dissenters, but also among those who, for whatever reason, tried to stick with the devil they knew. And unfortunately, what you are seeing at the level of states and the welcoming back of Syria, and by the way, it's not like Syria is now being welcomed back to Disneyland, it's the Arab League. So it's not like that far off from Syria, although it is far off in some ways. But I'm hopeful, theoretically, but in practice, I don't think we're seeing as much movement as we'd like in that direction that you mentioned.
Well, since we're in the Palestine center, though we focus more on how the Syrian war has affected the Palestinians, there was quite a large population of Palestinians in Syria. I think it was about 400,000, and they were very well constituted. They had access to social services, education, and employment. So I have two questions. What is the status of the Palestine community today in Syria? And if Assad got overthrown, would that whole support access from Iran through a little bit of Iraq all the way to Hezbollah in Lebanon be interrupted? And would that be sort of fatal to the Palestinian people?
I mean, I already addressed this. I don't think there is a vast difference between the conditions of Palestinians inside Syria and the rest of Syrians, not because of some sort of philosophy of equity, even though the Syrian regime and the prior one have actually treated Palestinians in a far more equitable manner than, say, Palestinian refugees in Lebanon. And that's because, and the reason why there's not much difference is because everyone in Syria is now, I mean, we're talking about 60 to 80%, depending on what you look at in terms of the source of statistics, are living under the poverty line. So there isn't much leeway there in terms of addressing differences. As to the second point, in terms of Syria's, you know, if the regime disappears or is overthrown, what does this do to the Palestine question? Well, let's start with what this does to Iran. And in many ways, the collapse or the failure or the overthrow of the Syrian regime would certainly isolate Iran in ways that are very significant. And if Iran is isolated, then its support for Hezbollah is going to lack the linchpin and the channel through which Iran arms and supports Hezbollah. So that's going to be a huge blow for that country and its politics, whatever these may be, and the connection with Hezbollah. This is one of the reasons why a lot of people were interested in sustaining the Syrian regime, not because of its own sake, but because of what this camp could serve in terms of a balance of power with Israel. Now, this narrative could be a bit inaccurate. My take could be a bit inaccurate, but no one can deny that this camp is now the only camp militarily that poses any threat to the state of Israel or a deterrence to the state of Israel, including Israeli military officials, as well as military journalists and scholars.
The last question is from Jihad Abu Salem, Executive Director of the Palestine Center that organized the event.
I have one more question, and we can conclude after that, if it's okay with everyone. I guess I get to have my one question. So this is a sore subject, and usually like the mood isn't like this in the room when we have events about Palestine, talking about, you know, resistance on the ground or the reality of Palestine, or bringing uplifting stories. And I think it's the role of spaces like this is to also have uncomfortable conversations. And I believe that this is the, you know, this is very important, not because, you know, not because we only care about Palestine, but we also care about our neighbors and our Arab brothers and sisters and about the region. And we don't want to see countries falling apart. We don't want to see civil wars. We don't want to see these things happening. However, do you think after more than a decade of what we have witnessed since the beginning of the Arab uprisings, do you think there is a... Because I want to talk a little bit about agency within the context of these states, within the context of these decision makers, within the context of these countries. Do you think there these regimes, these governments that not only Syria, where I'm trying to, you know, to zoom out a little bit, do you think they learned any lessons on how to avoid getting in situations like the ones we've witnessed throughout the past decade or more? And by that, I mean, some of the arguments that we heard in the past decade or so in approaching the Arab uprisings, and in a comparative sense, meaning that, you know, comparing different countries and the different outcomes that we've witnessed, geopolitics aside, and of course, you know, the interests of outside forces aside, there was a number of Arab intellectuals argued that the more the political space was eliminated within a given country, the more there was a tendency for that country to devolve into that kind of nihilistic, destructive rabbit hole of mutual destruction and the tendency to unleash forces of violence and so on and so forth. Can we say that the existing regimes, whether they were regimes that survived the last decade or regimes that, you know, came, that rose to power as a result of the last decade, Are they capable of learning that lesson? Are they capable of understanding that the more these political spaces are eliminated, the more there is an ability for elites, not in the, you know, like elitist sense, but as, you know, like leaders within the country, communities within a given country, the civil society, political parties, political forces to engage in processes of bargaining, of creating, of engaging in decision making that would spare these countries having to go through civil wars and civil strife? Can we say that this lesson has been learned? And what is the role, what is our role as intellectuals, academics, scholars who are interested in the region in creating different ways, different modes of thinking that would allow for that thinking to exist?
Thank you. That's a lot. But let me just try to summarize what I'm assuming you're getting at by saying that what we've learned and what Arab states have learned, because they're smart. Despite what people think, they're smart. They know how to stay on top. What we've learned is that the forces of counter-revolution are much stronger than the forces of revolution in the global south specifically. And this has taken place as a result of the intertwining of intervention slash imperialism, called what you will, on the one hand, and authoritarianism on the other, because they, as I shared, which is not something that I dealt into because this would have been much longer, they have actually benefited one another and reinforced one another. So what we've learned is that the forces of counter-revolution are far greater, and the tools available to them in terms of economics, in terms of financial support, in terms of weaponry, in terms of the ability strategically and otherwise to thwart movements, in terms of their ability to muddle and play a particular game that presents lesser evil as desirable, thereby returning back to what was the status quo. These are the sorts of things that we've learned in terms of the power of counter-revolution. If you look at the cases that started in 2011, experiencing mass protests, Syria is back with the Syrian regime in a much of a destitute country, but that actually is a situation where you have a return to the status quo in a much more ugly manner. If you look at Egypt, despite the Egyptian media that sings the praises of Sisi and the Egyptian regime, we also have the return to the status quo that is much worse than the prior status quo, because the prior status quo was one where you understood that it's a repressive regime that has no democratic legitimacy, whereas this one presents itself as being based on popular, some sort of a popular democratic support. And it's a regime that actually tolerates dissent far less. If you look at Bahrain, which lasted a very short period because of the intervention of Saudi Arabia and the silence of Europe and the United States vis-a-vis this intervention, because they don't want that to cause a domino effect, that situation in Bahrain to cause a domino effect in the Arab Gulf for obvious reasons. So we do have a return to the status quo, and that return is a testimony to the importance of that dynamic between authoritarian rule and international intervention, how they reinforce one another. Now, in terms of our role, I mean, I keep getting asked this question. Anybody who speaks keeps getting asked this question, what can we do? I don't know. I mean, of course, there's a lot that we can do. But the one thing that I always see myself saying is that let's not just wait until crisis erupt for us to basically say something. When Israel bombs Gaza to smithereens, we all get angry and become active in those 2 or 3 or 4 weeks. And then, you know, things move on and, you know, we're done. Even with the Twitter, with tweeting and being on social media, even that becomes more reduced after. There is a need for us to actually, as someone said, and I'm not going to quote them because they changed course. I don't know what's up with people changing course in this world, but I want to quote this person. And he said, there is no alternative to organizing. There is no alternative to organizing. So we can do a lot as individuals, and that's wonderful, but there's no alternative to organizing with each other, but also build bridges with people with similar goals, similar causes. that are not people that look like you, that talk like you, or that have the, you know, basically the same background. I think there is in my talk a serious critique, which I didn't develop on purpose, of the manner in which the world is organized today, the international state system. And I think one of the things that most of us can do is to actually reach beyond the borders of a nation state, but also, unfortunately, right, to also connect within the people that are within your nation state and organize. Those of us who live in the United States, as opposed to, for instance, people who live in Syria, have the freedom to actually organize and to connect and to build bridges so that the next time something happens, we are operating on a much more sound basis of collective action, of collective understanding. And if there is one thing that we all can do and we have not done in, during the uprising, especially with sensitive cases, is to try a bit harder not to just undermine each other, because we have some differences in the way we approach the same goal that we believe in. And that's something that I think would actually have been effective, more effective in supporting or critiquing or putting things on the right path, at least discursively. But I honestly see that there are limits to what we can do as individuals without organizing, without institutions, and without collective action within where we're at and across various settings. And that's basically like saying little. But you're asking a very big question, and I think big questions, you know, don't have really good answers.
And despite that, we have had a great conversation tonight. Professor Bassam Haddad, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
What you just heard was the question and answer session that followed the lecture delivered by Professor Bassam Haddad, titled Navigating Anti-Imperialism and Anti-Authoritarianism, the Syrian Uprising and the Question of Palestine. Bassam Haddad is an associate professor at the Shar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. He delivered that lecture on May 24, 2023, at the annual Hisham Sharabi Memorial Lecture hosted by the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. I aired that lecture during the previous episode of Arab Voices, and it is already archived on our website, arabvoices.net. For more information about the Palestine Center, visit the organization's website, and that's www.thejerusalemfund.org. You've been listening to Arab Voices, originating on KPFT Houston and syndicated on other radio stations in different cities in the U.S. and Europe. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.